Welcome back to another episode of the Talk Show podcast. I'm your host, Reese Howell. From this episode on, we're doing something a little different. We're stepping away from the usual well-worn topic of cycling and esports, and instead I'll be chatting to people who have directly or indirectly influenced me throughout my career. My first guest is a veteran from the world of advertising, having started his career at the agency HHCL, otherwise known as Howell Henry, which was named Agency of the Decade by Campaign Magazine in the year 2000. Now, even if you don't know the agency, you'll certainly know the adverts. At least you will if you lived in the UK in the 90s like I did. Perhaps the height of creative advertising in a pre-social media age. From Tango to Ronseal, Chaz Bayfield worked on some of the most iconic adverts in a generation. Adverts were not only taught to that generation, but helped to define it, becoming part of the very psyche of the nation. So it's my pleasure to chat to Chaz, find out what it was like back then, how things have changed, and what the future of advertising might hold. Chaz's resume and extensive experience speaks for itself, and it was a huge honor for me to chat to someone who helped make some of my favorite adverts of all time. Chaz, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's really great to have you here and to really get some insight from you. How are you doing?
Really well, Reese. Thank you very much for having me.
Cool. Where are you chatting to me from today?
I'm chatting to you from almost Antarctica. I'm down in Tasmania, Australia, which is pretty much as far as you can go. I think South Island, New Zealand's a little bit further south.
So that is a long way from where you're probably best known for, I guess, which is 90s London advertising scene. Which is the main kind of focus for our chat today. What I really wanted to know about is, you know, reading your background, the different things that you did before you really went into advertising. I'd be really interested to find out, like, how you kind of made that decision to go into advertising, what inspired you, and how did you make that leap? Because you were doing something kind of quite different beforehand.
I was doing lots of different things. I think it's fair to say I was quite directionless. I think a lot of people leave school or university and don't really have much of an idea. I'm envious of people who know they want to be doctors from the age of 10 or whatever, and they just focus on it. But I didn't. I went to it quite a roundabout way, I think. I killed a lot of time in Germany, first of all, because I studied German, and I worked for a car rental firm in, just let my dog out. Sorry about this. I have a needy dog and she kind of takes over my life sometimes. Yeah. I worked for a car rental firm in Hamburg, and that was pretty good, 'cause I was speaking German. I was living in Germany and I was getting the language a little bit better. I was also teaching in a number of head offices. I was teaching English. And one of the places I taught was an advertising agency, which was called Marzius, which was, I think they had a London office called DMB&B. No, I can't even remember. Darcy, which was a 90s agency in London. And I was teaching English to a couple of account directors there. And I just was so blown away by the work environment, the offices, the attitude, how intelligent they seemed to be. And I started thinking, let's think about that. And then went back to London. I worked in a lot of very kind of basic jobs because I thought I'm gonna make it in advertising. I ended up working in McDonald's, in Waitrose, in a bookshop in Kensington, just, you know, hourly work really, and trying to keep the dream alive. But it was the early 90s and there wasn't a huge amount of work going around, particularly not in advertising. But I knew that I wanted to do it, but I'd kind of doing German and living in Germany and working for a car rental firm probably isn't the most obvious way of getting into it.
No, not unless I guess you're doing advertising for cars, but there are some really great, actually, like old Volkswagen adverts, which are quite kind of self-deprecating, which I think is quite rare.
Yeah. Yeah, German advertising back then was very obvious. You know, there was a few beautiful things even then as somebody who wasn't, you know, really thinking about it. There wasn't a huge amount to excite me. But yeah, once I started thinking about it, I'd see a few little gems here and there.
Were there any particular adverts which stick out to you before you joined the advertising kind of industry, which kind of inspired you?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And ever since I was a kid, I realized I loved it long before I knew I loved it. One of my chores as a kid was burning the paper waste or the burnable waste, household waste. And we lived in the country and we could do that. And we'd have the Sunday magazines, the supplements. And I'd just go through it page by page because you put the whole magazine in and it wouldn't burn. You have to tear up each page and chuck it in the incinerator. And there were generally car ads. I think that's what drew me. I loved cars as a kid. And I remember there was an ad for Renault Fuego. And it just had one headline. It said aerodynamite. I remember thinking, oh, that is so cool. That is so cool. And then there was another one for Saab. And it just said the sky, it just had the sky. And then the next, you had to turn the page and then it had the Saab and a jet taken off above it. It said, is not the limit, even though it's such a basic line. But when I was like 12, 13, I thought, oh, that's going on the bedroom wall. So my wall was plastered with car ads. And I, as a sort of a slightly older human being, I didn't love the obvious one. I think there was an ad for Fiat Strada, which was built by robots, and it was just 60 seconds. And it was cars on a production line being made by robots to a classical piece of music.
Mm.
And I just remember getting spine tingles out of this. And I'd have only been a sort of slightly older teenager then. And yeah, the only other one I remember was a Nescafe one where a woman looked like she was about to top herself. She was driving a beagle to the cliffs. And she's looking at a glove compartment. I've got no idea what she's looking for. I'm quite scared to think what she might have been looking for, but she finds all the stuff that you need to make a cup of coffee. She's got a mug and she's got a little heater thing and a, I don't know what she's got. And I can see clearly now the rain has gone, comes on the radio and it's a sunrise and... Tearjerker, proper tearjerker. I bet he never won an award, but the young me thought that's what I want to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking of car ads, I think for as far as copywriting sort of goes, I think the car in front is a Toyota is the one which sort of sticks in your mind. It's obviously, I guess that's probably 90s era, and of course there was the Durchsprung Technik. Which was the like Frischilian Vice style thing with all of the bits kind of bouncing and falling together. That's probably the one which sort of stings out. But like, even now I think of that Toyota kind of catchphrase. Don't see many Toyotas, but
no.
Rings true. It was clever, I think.
Yeah, it was just a different era where there were ads and slogans and things were simple. Things were just very, very simple. And it was a technique that if you could do it, you could do it. And you could, you know, you could get famous by doing it really well. And you'll probably come onto this later, but the ground rules have changed so dramatically since then that I think a lot of people are left going, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to do this thing. What do you want me to do? And I think that's challenging for a lot of people. But back then it was a simple trick. You could either write that line or you couldn't.
Yeah. So what was your first real job, I guess, in the advertising industry?
First job was at HHCL and Partners, which isn't there anymore. They were like a firework. They dazzled briefly and then disappeared. But I think it was about a 10-year dazzle. It was just lovely to have been in that place. It felt like the hottest hot shop on the planet. And it sounds really corny. I've never worked anywhere that resembles it. And I don't think I've met anyone who worked there at that time who's ever worked anywhere. There's just such nostalgia and love for that place. Because it didn't seem to be driven by making money, and it didn't seem to be driven by winning awards. It was driven by doing famous work and breaking rules, and trying to create something that sold stuff, but was really, really creative, really interesting, and had, they had so many different tones of voice. Whereas some agencies, you kind of know which agency it's from.
Yeah.
You know, they're never going to really make you laugh, and they'll never make you totally shocked or anything. It's so middle. And I think Hal Henry was just fabulously experimental. It missed it sometimes. It got things really wrong, but it was great. I was there for about 10 years, I think. And yeah, I'm so thankful that I had that, you know, that 8 years was absolutely brilliant.
I think you say on your website that you didn't have a house style, but you had sort of a house standards.
That was it.
Which I think's a really interesting way of phrasing it. And I think how did it work? Like, because if you sort of don't have that house style, that means that the creatives must have a lot of freedom. So what was that kind of creative environment like to be? Was it like this perfect kind of Goldilocks combination where you had really great clients who were open to big ideas? Did you actually have to do a lot of kind of convincing the people who worked there as well? Were they all kind of interested in this kind of passion for making really interesting kind of adverts? And was it that just everything sort of seemed to just be perfect at the right time? Or how was it for you?
I think it was that Goldilocks thing. And I feel that advertising coming through the 80s and into the 90s had been very corporate and quite high budget, very glossy. And it had been quite a brutal environment in some agencies, certainly some of the bigger ones anyway. And it felt like Hal Henry was a bit of a refuge. It felt like people had escaped these other agencies, perhaps weren't earning as much money as they might have done there, and were just free to do the very best work that they could. And I foolishly thought when I got in that they were crazy people. Can't say crazy, sorry about that. Very anarchic, kind of out there, radical punk. And my tutor at college had warned us that this was an agency that didn't really follow the rules. And to his credit, once we got hired there, he sent everybody this is Tony at Watford, sent everybody at Watford our way. The agency at one point, I think over half our creative department was from Watford. But it wasn't those people. Those people weren't, they might have done work like that, but they were really calm, quiet, hardworking, diligent, intelligent people. And I found that really refreshing because I was terrified of the whole punk thing and the let's go out and break everything, and you know, that wasn't really the agenda. There were really good people there, people who were very glad to be there and very relieved to be there. The clients, I don't know whether that was just serendipitous or whether they sought out clients who just had really open minds and a huge amount of trust. And I think there were probably difficult clients who we found harder to work with, but Britvic, who made Tango, were a dream, really, particularly one or two of the clients there. And because of that work, the agency obviously attracted other clients who wanted to be in the slipstream of that and get some of that for them. So they weren't going to ask us to do something deeply corporate and dull. So it was a combination of that, but it felt like, at the time we got hired, it felt like signing for Man City or Arsenal or someone like that. It was like, not only have I got a job probably for the rest of my career, my working life, if I can keep doing this, but I'm in this Premier League of advertising thinking. And I was just so excited to be there. And I just worked and worked and worked and, you know, spent every living hour there. I think I was just drunk on the place. It was, I was probably its biggest cult member.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
a bit like that.
Looking at the, I guess, portfolio of adverts for HHCL kind of created, it's probably no surprise that you felt that way. I think Tango as well is the one which, at least for me, being you know, quite young in the 90s, that really stood out to me in particular, just I think because of the sheer surrealness of it. And there aren't that many, you're used to being advertised in a particular way, and there were a lot of ads which kind of came out in the 90s which were sort of surreal, and they felt very like, this is British humor. But that Tango one was so weird, I guess, like, because what's interesting, it's sort of surreal product marketing in a sense, because it's kind of demonstrating the sensation of drinking Tango by being kind of slapped in the face. But it also seems weird, having worked in agencies and tried to, you know, pitch stuff in the noughties, not used to saying noughties, but in the 2000s, the very kind of different approach, a lot of hesitancy. But do you think that you said that Britvic, they were great clients, but were they really open to these kind of more surreal ideas, or did it take a bit of work to kind of get them on board with that?
I don't know. I always find that interesting, because the Tango stuff was different, because it wasn't beautiful American teens riding bikes through fountains with a classic rock track in the background. It wasn't lifestyle advertising, which is what soft drinks were generally doing. And I remember when I first saw that, I was on placement at another agency, and somebody was doing a sort of a taping of the Tango ad. And that, just seeing that, was the first time in my life I'd ever laughed out loud at an advert. And my partner and I decided that was, we had to find out which agency, which is quite hard pre-internet, which agency had done it, which team had done it. And we have to call them, and we have to go in and show them our portfolio, because we had lots of stuff that we thought was funny in our portfolio, but it wasn't really going down that well. So, you know, it was, but when you look at the ad, when I got there and actually spoke to the people who made it, they said it's just 100% product demonstration. It's so branded. It's just the hit of oranges. It's a metaphor. You know, the hit of oranges is an orange guy wearing a nappy who comes and slaps you in the face or kisses you. And then you've got someone saying, yes, that's a quintessential taste sensation of time. It's almost the brief. The voiceovers are reading the brief, and you're watching the effect that's going on. It's such brilliant advertising. And I think maybe that's what Britain was shocked at. It's like, oh my goodness, someone's actually selling me something. And it worked. And what Tango kept on doing was telling people about the product and how it affected them and why it was good, and just bashing them with it. What looked surreal to start off with, when you got into the weeds, you realized, oh, actually, that's just really, that's some very brainy planners and a very savvy client who's gone, yeah, when you put it like that, yeah, great creative directors who just encouraged and pushed it, fantastic creative team who made it. It was brilliant.
And whoever wrote the copy at the end, you know, when you've been tangoed,
yes,
is also a genius line just to leave people with as well.
Definitely. It was Al Young and Trevor Robinson, and John Leach was the planner, and Steve Henry was the creative director. And I'm sure one of them came up with that genius. But it was also that was brilliantly funny. But then you had the Fourth Emergency Service from the AA, which was really serious. It was like an emergency film. You know, it was like, you know, you're not going to call this number, you're not going to call this, to our members, we are the Fourth Emergency Service. It was like, wow, you know, saying, wait a minute, we're the Fourth Emergency Service. And then you have the same team who do that, Liz Whiston and Dave Shelton, come up with, it does exactly what it says on the tin, which people say over here in Australia. I'm hearing it over in Australia, Tasmania, people are saying, does exactly what it says on the tin. And I'm like, I know the people who wrote that. It's just...
Well, it's so in the...
Once again, isn't it?
That phrase, it feels like it must have pre-existed kind of the advert. I actually now say if something does do what it says on the tin, or it does what it's supposed to do, I just say, oh, that's Ronseal now.
I don't know. I just assume that it was, you know, it's just so blindingly obvious. That's the first time I ever heard it, and that was mid-90s. It was never in the language before then, unless somebody might have just said, someone's nan might have said that.
Yeah.
You know, brown sauce. It's exactly what's in the bottle or something.
Yeah. No, it's amazing how so many of those amazing, like, yeah, phrases are just kind of ingrained in me. I don't think I've ever drunk a pint of Harp lager, but Time for a Cool Sharp Harp as well is something which it's always in my head. Like, if I want to go for a drink, but that beer, I don't think I've ever drank it in my entire life. So, so what would be, you know, you spent best part of a decade at HHCL. Is there like a one single piece which you worked on, which you just say, this was the kind of the highlight of my time there?
Yeah, I mean, just for different reasons. I mean, the ad that I did there that's got the most accolades is the Blackcurrant Tango, and it was a bitch to work on. It was really, really high stress. It was very, very, very hard work to pull that off and just get everything done and delivered. And there were other shoots that were just hilarious or more adventurous. We had to do some sponsorship idents for The Word on Channel 4.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time it was a graphic design exercise and the budget matched that. It was just I think Swatch had been doing it, and it was just a little animation, and it was an art directional thing. And we thought, well, we worked out, we had to do 102 brake bumpers and we could shoot 102 different bits of film. And it was fabulous. We got to work with kids' TV presenters. We got to work with all kinds of different people. We got a minibus down to Cornwall and we used some of my teachers in the ad, used my dad. It was just so handmade. It was like film school students going out with a camera and just catching whatever we could. And we got a D&AD Silver. Only my partner did, because he's the art director. I didn't get one because idents didn't have copywriting back then. So that was nice. Changed the rules on that. But there's probably a lot of other things. It was just loads of firsts, loads of things that we did. We did a campaign for Steel Tango, which we made it look like it was a pirate product, and we shot it in a club under the Westway, and it looked really dodgy. And then we shot the marketing director of Britvic saying, this is not licensed by Tango, and if you see it anywhere, mm-hmm. number. And it was, I think we had about 500,000 people giving us their phone numbers and addresses, and we could then send really weird bits of junk mail to them and freak them out, which was just what Tango wanted to do. So that was good. I mean, there were just so many little bits and pieces that were just fun to do, because the rule was never say no. No one was allowed to say no at Hal Henry. It probably changed after time, but if you said, I want Martin Scorsese to direct this, the producer had to find out where he was and at least ring his people and then come back and say, ah, he's busy shooting some major blockbuster. But yeah, it was always everything's possible, and when everything's possible, you're not limited. You haven't got that experience of computer says no all the time, and you go, oh, we could do this, we could try that, we could, you know, we, instead of doing an advert, let's just litter Glastonbury with empty bottles of the product before it comes out, which we did for another Tango drink. And it felt like, well, that's what people are doing now, because the internet's here and social media's here, and people are going, oh, what's this? You know, why have Coke brought out a, you know, don't know, a green can or a whatever, a black can. And it's like, yeah, it's sort of becomes social content. But back then in the 90s, it was nothing. It was just, you hope somebody would see it and go, that's interesting.
Yeah. I think I could see why, just thinking about the Blackcurrant Tangos, the St. George advert, I can see why. I've watched the making of, and I hadn't also fully appreciated how, I guess, strenuous and big it was. I guess because the actual finished product looks so seamless. It's so well produced, and the cut as well between the office part and the where the big lorry is, and then out onto the cliffs. It's so seamless as well. It's so well done. So I could also see why, actually, maybe it's not necessarily your favorite one to have necessarily to have worked on. But
it was definitely my favorite one as far as what it did for me and my career and everything. But yeah, you watch the making of it, was very difficult, but the people were very, very professional, very old school, because that's the way everything was old school. You had crew of thousands and everything was worked out to the nth degree. It was just the idea itself was very different. You know, what looks like a corporate video in an office turns into this cinematic widescreen epic. And it just looks like you don't know when it's going to end, because you're used to it in 10 seconds where it hasn't ended. Okay, maybe it's a 20, or maybe it's a 30, or maybe it's a 60. It's like, when's it going to stop?
And it just keeps escalating.
Yeah, it does. It keeps growing, yeah. And it doesn't seem to have any cuts in it, which is... Yeah, it seems quite a technique now. You can.
I think also I don't know if gimbal technology has improved, but that first shot, to me, I just thought, it must be someone just holding a camera. And then when you watch the making of, there's that whole track which is kind of created, and the I think at some point there's where the steps there's a pass off as well or something, and it's And then it's running out here to where they're walking across the car park. It's it's a little bit like there's that magician show where they tell you how all the tricks are done, then all of a sudden, in so it's super interesting because of course you're like, almost how the trick's done is okay. It takes away some of the magic, but it almost adds something more because I could never imagine it being done in this way. So. So if you're listening and you've not seen the making of the advert, you should definitely go watch it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, I haven't aged a bit.
I can concur, especially for the people just listening to audio. One thing which I was interested in, I mean, I love that advert. I think it's so emblematic of the 90s, but there's some bits around it when you rewatch it under the lens of where we are today, post Brexit, for example. And I think it's really interesting when you think about it. And it starts off where it's what's the kid's name? It's like a French exchange student who writes in with the initial complaint.
Yeah.
And then it's, there's that bit where he says, "You're one dissenting voice in a billion, Johnny French," and he's like, "You're that."
Yes.
Which I think they did this bit, like, you can't, if you're listening, you can't see this, but I think he did that several times. It was very important that this bit was done, and he does it so well. And then, of course, then it ends with this sort of battle scene on the cliffs of Dover.
Yes.
Finishing off with some Harrier jets. It's quite confrontational, but at the time, this was sort of like, it fitted into sort of a bit of a sort of, I guess, a lad culture. We had Euro 96.
Yeah.
And it was always kind of jokey, this sort of, you know, whatever, anti-French, anti-German kind of rhetoric, especially when it came to like football, especially losing against Germany in the Euros. How do you feel that, I'm not saying, there's no way advertising is like responsible for like Brexit, but do you ever think about like how all of those kind of adverts sort of fitted into that part of the British psyche from that era, and how maybe it's not responsible, but how do you think like it's part of the path, I guess, towards kind of Brexit? Do you ever think about it in that sort of way? Because I never have until I went back and watched the adverts, and I was like, okay, yeah. It's really interesting to see it through this new lens, I guess.
I totally get it, and people have said that. And in its defense, I'll answer your question and say, in its defense, it was really a veiled attack on Coca-Cola, because they were the only other drinks brand that could do an ad that long and that expensive. And it was that's who Ray was taking on. He was taking on the world. And at the time, I was a member of so many charities. I was Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Anti-Vivisection. Oh my goodness, there were loads of Amnesty. I was just getting all kinds of stuff coming in the post, and I read about the French who were blasting nuclear bombs off the north of New Zealand, and at some point they'd blown up the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace ship in Auckland Harbour, and it felt like, yeah, they deserve this. My much younger head is like, we're going to have a pop, and knowing also that at the time, because you're kind of a product of as you're brought up, you're not brought up in a vacuum. If you're English, you don't like the Scottish and you don't like the French, and nobody really likes their neighbours. I think even now people are sort of, you look at, you know, the way the world is and the amount of neighbours who just sort of jar with each other. So there was a little element of that. And I think the whole Britpop thing made people feel really good about Britain, the new Labour for a huge amount of people. It was a new dawn. Everyone was excited. You know, Oasis were huge. So many bands were huge, and a lot of advertising was really, I'd say, quintessentially British. It wasn't trying to be anything else. Remember an ad with Peter Kay where he just jumps in for John Smith.
Yeah.
He just jumps into there's a dive and he just bombs into the pool.
Yeah.
Like, yep, that's British. That's British. And it felt like advertising was creating part of that cultural identity as it lived in film and in TV. And I'm sure there were a ton of TV shows and movies, and Bond was pretty big back then as well. And he's your perfect exemplar of sort of slightly bigoted British bloke. As to how much that ingrained in people who ultimately voted for Brexit, I don't know, but I do look at the ad now and I feel a little twinge of, well, I wouldn't write that now, and that's not helpful. And it was okay, lad culture and the culture we're in, it felt okay to knock stuff and to be almost unkind to people. If you remember the number of comedians who would just ambush celebrities in the Dennis Dennis kind of thing, or the whole idea is to make somebody look a fool and to, yeah, just to embarrass them. And if you could do it for real on TV, then you got extra points. And it was just being just shock people. Let's just shock people. And I think at least the Blackcurrant Tango one was being overt and honest. And I think it was the next year, it was the World Cup and Tango were giving away TVs. And Ray Gardner had to do the advertising. It was on radio. And Scotland were in the World Cup as well. It was England and Scotland. And he said, I'll be really honest, we absolutely gutted if the Scots won, even though this is competition for you. But as there's no bias, we're going to get the winner picked by the Welsh. It's like it's arranged for someone in Wales to pick out who the winner was. But yeah, he was just very, we were much more upfront about it because it was comedy value. We knew that a lot of people at the time would go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, well, the people who drank Tango probably were, because they were young guys between 16 and 24. It was sort of that was our sweet spot. Whether they then grew up to be the Brexit voters, don't know. I think it was a big cultural change since the 90s.
Yeah.
It's better.
I think there is there was a positivity, I guess, around the British identity in the 90s. I think that's definitely true. Especially so, before we started this podcast, I saw an advert from Liverpool Football Club. I'm not really into football, but I saw this advert, and it's it was in the style of Windows 95. And they had an upbeat kind of house track, very reminiscent of, I guess, the mid-90s. And the kit is actually a rework of a 95-96 season kit. And there's a lot of that kind of going on. And also, I think a couple of days ago, I found out that there's this big music track, and it's a sort of techno remix of the Spice Girls' Wannabe, which also came out about the same time.
Union Jack dress was like, that was an epic symbol of, it felt like a huge amount of British pride that hasn't, you know, has dwindled. And perhaps it's the memory of that. Because people always like a golden age, don't they? They think it was a golden age. Actually, it probably wasn't really a golden age. And the best time is almost always now, for most people. But yeah, you look back on, you cherry pick and you go, yeah, that was great. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a little bit of the 70s. And it was nothing like any 70s thing I've ever seen or any show in the 70s. Like, people didn't walk around with afros dancing to disco. That's generally not what they did. They had bad teeth and women wore headscarves, the older ones did anyway, and it was all very brown and gloomy. It was gloomy, and there were strikes and riots. Oh my goodness, it was just Billy Elliot. Probably that's maybe that's 80s, isn't it? But yeah, you can look through rose-tinted lenses at any era and go, oh, it was better back then, let's bring that here.
Which is I think a big driver generally for, I guess, the talking about Brexit, that kind of Brexit vote. It was a lot of it was driven by nostalgia, and not just like 90s, definitely. It's all of the years before that, probably, you know, like even 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe not 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, which drove that. But I think that definitely it feels, sorry?
I'd just like to apologise for Brexit before we go any further.
Yeah, I'm not placing the blame fully on you. That's not why we're here. I just think it's really, I think it's unfair, and people often make this mistake, to judge things from different eras by the standards of the modern day. Some things you can do, but I think it's a mistake to always do that. But it's, for me, it's interesting to look at, like, how do you connect all of those sort of dots together? So going from, you know, traveling through time to where we are now, and just seeing, like, is there, you know, how did that possibly kind of play a part? And it's not one single advert, but it was that whole culture. I mean, you know, even to think about, like, completely different topic, but like Page Three Girls, for example, and magazines like Loaded and Maxim and FHM, like,
boobs everywhere, wasn't it, in the 90s? It was just
massive. I mean, like, you know, at least of people around like my age, I'm currently 38, you know, Loaded was like the magazine to buy. Like, that was sort of a status symbol, like when you're in school, to kind of have this magazine. Too many words for like a teenager, but a lot of it was very kind of funny.
It was funny. Really well written.
Yeah, it was very, very, very well written. But it all kind of tied into that kind of, you had that lad culture. You had Sarah Cox, who was very famous as like the ladette, kind of the female version of lad culture. But it all still was very sort of tongue-in-cheek. So it felt very sort of playful still a lot of the time, especially like in the yeah. advertising world. So it didn't feel too, I guess, like dangerous or threatening or
no, it didn't. It was I think it was fun if you were in the club. I think if you weren't in the gang, it was probably felt quite excluded from it. And it felt like a very kind of not alpha, but very sort of heterosexual, red blooded, all lads together, quite rugby sort of med student, frat boy thing. And if girls were down with it, great. And it kind of, I don't think it could have survived much longer than it did.
Mm.
I think people just grew up. I think it felt like a real, you're probably the perfect age for it. I think if you're a little bit older, you probably looked at it and went, oh yeah, that's a bit off. That's a bit, you know, but you know, no one was really complaining about it at the time. I'm sure some people were, but
yeah. I
don't know how seriously they were taken. They were pigeonholed as prudes and.
Sure. Yeah, we're definitely looking at it through, you know, our own personal kind of experiences. People definitely yeah. would have experienced it differently. But I think also looking around sort of who were my peers at the time. I mean, I also went to an all-boys school, so that also it's not the best pool of people to kind of get a feeling for that stuff. But
I imagine, yeah.
One thing I want to we'll continue on like that transition between kind of advertising then and advertising now, but there was one thing which I just wanted to quickly ask you about, and it was after you left HHCL, I think you set up your own agency, Arkwright, I believe. Yeah. And one of the things you said that you realized that running a company actually wasn't very fun. And I wanted to just like ask about that. What was it which you found to be like the least enjoyable bit about that? Because obviously the plus side of it is that you have a lot more kind of control. The yeah. downside in my mind would be like, yeah, you end up being pulled away from creativity to hunt like for new clients and pitch work and try to survive. Is that the bit which wasn't fun? Yeah. Or
yeah, yeah. I forced myself to never ever look at it nostalgically and to always remember what a bloody awful time it was. It was brutal. If you're not good at new business, if you're not good at cold calling or smooth talking or making out that you're doing really well, that was the thing I found the hardest, was going into meetings with media agencies and other partners who had clients that we might be able to help out on, and making out that you're doing really well when you've actually got holes in your shoes, holes in your pockets, no food in the cupboards. You're almost physically unwell because you're not eating properly. You were spending, I think I used to spend 24p on a can of Safeway tomato soup and a bread roll. And it was depressing. It was just depressing. It seemed to rain all the time. And it was in Camden and it was just like so miserable. It was just the... it was bad, and I didn't take any joy in creative freedom because we were just so desperate to work. We would take anything, and if you stop being objective, you go, I have to do this in order to live, and if I say no to this and they leave, my goodness, and it's incredible that we actually did some work that I quite enjoy, I quite like. But, you know, the best project we did there, I think, was a free one. It was a pro bono one. So, you know, you just do what you want.
Yeah, I did wonder because I think that's very relatable. If you are more on the creative side, that whole... people normally fall into one bucket. You're either like a creative or you're kind of more of a salesperson. And, of course, it's a spectrum, but... having worked with a bunch of people who work in sales, they're sort of different beings and they love it. Like they love to go out and get clients. And I've always been one of those people who's just like, I want to do the work. Like, and I've also sort of been in that scenario where I was working as a consultant and trying to get clients to line up was super difficult. And I was living off of my Boots loyalty cards. I'd walk to the agency and then buy a Boots meal deal at lunchtime and then walk home until I eventually got my invoices paid. So
I sympathize with that. I had a child savings account with the post office that I forgot I had, and suddenly it was like, I remember this, and it amounted to about £16, and I spent it in Safeway just buying some groceries. I'd saved up as a kid.
I plundered my Woolwich Building Society account. My mum was very disappointed, but I don't think Woolwich exists anymore. Society, not the place.
No, it's just very, it's very difficult because some people are absolutely incredible at selling themselves and their products, and I knew that I wasn't, and you know it was. I'm glad that I did it, but there's a TV show, I don't know if you come across it, Alone, where they stick people in a remote part of Vancouver Island, 10 people, all separate, with 10 items each, and they're just told to survive. And it's the one who survives out there the longest. They win $500,000 or something. And I felt like that. It feels like that. It's like you are just, how long can you survive? And these guys, they might catch a fish every 5 days, and they can just about get a few calories. That was like us, like a tiny little fish every so often. And you knew there's no way we can live off this. We can't. It's not sustainable. And how do you just keep it going out of pride because you've told everyone in campaign, have written a big thing that you've left HHCL and now you're going to do this thing and everyone's waiting. And, you know, everyone forgets you as soon as you're out of a big agency. It's incredible. Certainly the industry magazines, well, campaign at the time, if you're not one of the big ones, no one cares, which is weird because even then there were lots of little tiny startups around the place.
Mm-hmm.
Doing probably more work between them than the big agencies, but yeah, you're the coal that's fallen out of the fire. That was really tough as well.
Yeah, very relatable. And also, I'm always thinking about, how should I go back and sort of do my own thing? And it's exactly that thing about that split of, you know, the hunting for work and actually being able to do the work, which is the bit which always puts me off doing it. So I work and have done for the least pretty much best part of a decade in the cycling industry. And I think it is probably one of the most boring with regards to advertising, almost on the planet. And there's been very little innovation. So I'm constantly thinking, like, there's got to be a better way for like marketing these products in a more kind of enjoyable way. Cause it's just very, everything is so dry. And so that's why I'm always constantly thinking, like, should I do it? And I'm always put off because I know how tough it is. So talking about kind of, I guess, modern day, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts, really. We just had Cannes, so what better time to really talk about like the current, I guess, state of advertising? How do you feel that, you know, in your opinion, what do you think is kind of the current state of advertising? Is there, personally, I feel that there is a little bit of joy missing, maybe like some fun, some surrealness. But I'd love to get your kind of take on it. I think you wrote on your blog you watched all of the winners, so you probably have as good an idea as anyone on, you know, well, the current state. And there's also this sort of split between adverts which kind of win or get entered into Cannes, and then what actually ends up going on to TVs. But there is kind of a difference there. But you know, generally speaking, it gives you a good indicator.
I think it's hard to look at Cannes and say that's representative of advertising, because it's just its own thing, really. And I think it's at some point it's morphed into a, wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, let's let's do an amazing PR stunt that is either quite moving or very clever or affects change in a positive way. And there's, I really liked all the 34 Grand Prix winners had merit, obviously, but I couldn't connect them to the work that I'm expected to do week in, week out for whoever's given me any work. That there were, you mentioned joy. I think there were two winners that were what I call overtly entertaining, meant to be entertaining, had funny content, which is very low. It's very low. And it made me feel that purpose has got to be earnest. And we said right at the beginning that the territory has changed so much since I started in the 90s, where you were creating bits of film to interrupt, to entertain, to make people think differently. And you got into advertising because you knew that the work you were doing, if it was good enough and if it got played in the right areas, would be seen by people and talked about by people. It might even affect the culture. It might even start getting into other things on TV, or someone in the paper would write about it, or it would get included in a political speech. Your slogan would be, it would have a greater shelf life than just in the advertising. Whereas the stuff that I see at Cannes, I get the feeling that a very small audience might have seen it and might have been moved by it and affected by it. And some of the PR might have been really effective, but the news cycle is so fast that any of those things is probably only going to get a day, 2 days if you're lucky. I mean, think how many really big news stories stay in the news cycle for that long. It's got to be a massive thing. Yeah. A food delivery service tracking the World Cup coming back to Argentina, I can imagine, yeah, that would make a nice little news story, a little and finally. But it's not going to be talked about, I don't think. I don't know, I'm not in Argentina, but it's not huge. Whereas it does exactly what it says on the tin, is still being spoken 30, 25 years after it was first written or used in an advert. And that feels like really strong advertising. So this the Cannes stuff is very much, it's kind of PR. So that I think of that as separate, because I think the actual advertising that we're having to do is so different again from what I was doing at the start of my career. And it's much harder to do. It's much harder to do things that are really, really funny, because you've got to be so careful. Mm-hmm. Because humor usually involves somebody being the brunt of the joke. And if it can be interpreted that that person is the brunt of the joke because of a protected characteristic of any kind, then people get nervous. Yeah. So you end up having something that's a little bit sterile, or a bit, you go worthy, because worthy's safe. If we're friends with absolutely everybody, then we're on a winner. But then when everybody's doing the same thing, it's just bland. Everybody's bland. And it's just a difficult word. And there are so many unwritten rules that when you're making a piece of advertising, you know, how you cast the advertising is really important. But you often think this isn't through any sense of actual desire for inclusion. This is virtue signaling. And then you think, mm-hmm. I'm part of this. Or this is greenwashing. This is, I'm doing something to make a corporate feel good about itself, but they don't actually think that. And I think that I found that frustrating. I found it quite frustrating. Most of my career, I've been fighting to get minorities in advertising, trying to get people in a wheelchair in an advert in the 90s. And we were told by the client, oh, we can't do that. We can't have your lead character, this inspirational boss, in a wheelchair because we don't have a ramp. And it was like something, just tell the creative something. We are not having our chief in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. We can't, one brand wouldn't let us, we had to have white people in it. were actually mandated because the Germans wouldn't buy it if it was people of color. In the end, we found a Japanese kid, and it seemed to like we won. We got that through. And I remember just trying to cast for black actors in the early 2000s was so much harder. And it was like, because nobody was really doing it. Nobody was doing it. And it wasn't like, hey, look at us. We didn't do a great PR splash about it. It was like,
yeah.
And then at some point, probably over the last 5-10 years, it's flipped. It's flipped. And now you feel, well, it's fantastic, but it's become a, you question people's intention or what's behind this. Is this because you're good people and you love a world where everyone can just be alongside each other, or you're just going, there's bucks in this, there's money in this, we'll put these people in this ad, we'll have a gay couple kissing. Is that just, you know, a lot of your friends are gay and you kind of, that's the world that you're in, or you're just thinking, no, the public want that and we'll do that. And it just seems to come from a corporate place. Pride as well, the way that clients have just, brands have just jumped on this thing, and rightfully a lot of people are saying, well, wait a minute, this was our thing, and now you do this corporate fest, and we've got no idea throughout the other 11 months of the year, what actually are you doing, what actually have you got in place? And some of them I'm sure have, but it just feels like someone's put 5 minutes thought into it and gone, oh yeah, I'll stick a rainbow flag next to our logo, yay. And it just comes, it's all coming from the wrong place. And I think
it feels like it's driven by fear, to be honest. There's a mixture of things where it's fear of, fear. When you see everybody else doing like pride stuff, then you feel, oh, we've also got to do pride.
Well, that's
it. You don't want to, if we don't do pride, then everyone's going to think we're bigoted. And then it creates this weird sort of, mad rush to be like, oh, we've got to do it. Otherwise, people are suddenly going to think the wrong thing about us, which I don't think is true. I feel like especially if you just do it for the sake of it, it's worse. And I think it ends up being worse for Pride, because then you get a lot of people going like, why does this brand have to be involved with Pride? They have nothing to do with Pride. And those people are right. Like the brand, as you were saying, like what are they doing for the other 11 months of the year? Well, not a lot normally. And so it feels like a lot of it's driven through fear alone.
I think, I think it is. It's fear and, being worried that the, you know, two people on Twitter will say, oh, wait a minute, you look at you racists. And I just think that there's no sense of how can we do this in a really creative way? So if you go, well, yeah, we live in a very diverse country. I mean, obviously you're in Germany and I'm in Australia, but let's think about the UK. Yeah. You know, it's a fabulously diverse country, and particularly in the cities, the major cities. And you look at advertising and you'll see black people, but you won't necessarily see Filipinos or people from Nepal or people from people with very, very pronounced accents from the Far East, or people with, you won't necessarily see a black person with a strong Ghanaian accent or Nigerian accent, or even a particularly strong West Indian accent. You're generally allowed to have someone who sounds, you know, like they were born in the UK and they've integrated, because that'll keep all the racists happy. So we're doing our virtue signal. Yeah, we've got, look, we've got a black person in an advert. And it's like, well, why haven't you got a woman in a burqa in an advert? You know, two women in a burqa sharing a joke. It would be great. I'd love to see that. Been trying to do that for the last 20 years. But it's always got to be, you know, your inclusion and diversity is within such a small little window, because it's like they don't want to scare the pigeons. And I think if you're going to do it, really do it. Which we did an ad for an insurance brand, and the client mandated how many of the cast needed to be non-white. And the casting agent came up with you know, a couple of people who, you know, really handsome guy, and it's another guy, and they were, I think, originally of West Indian descent. And I said, yeah, all right, well, we'll have one, we'll have this guy here, but can I have a Sikh? I want a Sikh. And they go, we don't have any Sikhs on our books. And it's like, okay, well, that's interesting that you don't, what, do Sikhs just not want to act, or, you know, or is it because they know they're not going to get a gig because they're a Sikh? And in the end, someone said, well, I've got a mate who's a cab driver in Birmingham called John. And we got John in, and he was great. He was great. He became one of the people at the party. And I thought, oh, that was a win, because it wasn't the most creative ad.
Mm-hmm.
But it, at least I just made them work hard for it. It's like, don't just dial it in. Really annoyed that. I think that's the thing that has annoyed me the most in recent years is how people are kind of, ooh, do we look like we're being inclusive? Yeah, I think we do. I think we got away with it. And nothing's changed.
I have something relatable in a slightly different direction. Just for the last company I was at, I was planning a brand. It was mainly advertising campaign. And one of the ideas was, so it was an e-bike company, and the tagline was apologies from Ampler. So I wanted to make it so that essentially the brand, instead of saying all the things it's kind of good for, is more like, here's, because of the benefits of an e-bike, you're going to end up finding yourself in these awkward situations because you haven't taken into account the benefits, in a sense. So an e-bike being, you're going to travel across the city much quicker than you would ever expected to once you first got one. So I had this video idea. The person calls up the butchers, say, or puts in an order, gets on their e-bike, rides across their little kind of German town, gets to the butchers, and then the butcher gets up, and then is unexpected that the person's arrived so early, and then just passes the person a small piglet. And and then the person then has to ride away kind of with the piglet in the basket. And it was kind of more like, yeah, get used to being early. And it was like a set of different ideas around that. But as soon as people were like, ooh, butchers, pigs, like the animal activists are going to be all over us. And I was like, well, but the pig lives. So it was very interesting to kind of gauge people's reactions to even something which I thought was just a, you know, funny little idea, and they were already kind of scared of it, even though they're laughing.
Isn't it? It's fear, and it's like, well, I'm not offended by it, but somebody will be. And it's like, well, you're not offended by it, and you're the marketing department. That's your job. Your job is to, you know, you channel the brand, you live the brand, you are the brand, and just be the brand and see what is the worst that can happen. If you're doing something that's so utterly crass, and ads have done that, but no one's really going to pull you up, I don't think, for, you know, for being funny and, you know, tastefully funny, or just being, having some little spark that sets you apart from other people.
So, I mean, that when I was kind of presented the idea to the whole business, it's the only time I've ever heard everybody pretty much laugh, or apart from one person who was shouting, no, which also in my mind, if you have people laughing and other people going, no, you can't do it, you've probably done something right. It's worse, obviously, if everybody's has no reaction. Yeah. But it was also interesting telling people, and they were like, ooh. And I was like, I think if people go, ooh, then for me personally, I go, well, there must be something to this, because if you have no reaction, then that's the worst outcome in my mind that you could have, other than being massively go out of your way offensive. I feel like that fear definitely, like, it's something which sort of persists in the mind of a lot of people.
Well, it does, and what it ends up doing is making very bland work, because for work to stand out, there's got to be something to it. There's got to be some kind of edge or spike or something that just unsettles or wrong foots or does something. And when brands are spending thousands of thousands of pounds on making stuff, and it is just vanilla. It's like, what is the point of doing that? There is no point. You're just being the same as everybody else. Your car ad is going to look like theirs. Your sportswear ad is going to look like theirs. Your activation is going to be similar to theirs because everyone's trying to, you know, do really worthy right on things. It baffles me why people spend so much to be so quiet.
Yeah. So one of the last things I wanted to touch upon, which I'm pretty sure it's new, or it's new in the last 10 years, is this, at least as far as the UK public go, and their attention to advertising, as in anticipation, has seemed to be drawn a lot around Christmas. Mm. And it used to be Christmas, and Coca-Cola was one of my clients, so they said at one point, and they always said, Christmas period starts when our advert comes on the TV, when the holidays are coming thing. And so we basically dictate when Christmas starts. And I think that was still, you know, to be fair to them, it was very true that that sort of did feel like that as a consumer. Mm. But, you know, in more recent years, it feels like everybody is waiting to see what advert at Christmas is going to make me cry the most.
Mm.
And it seems to be a bit of a, for me personally, it seems a bit of a weird kind of thing, which we've kind of got going on at the moment, like lots of brands piling in to try and make us well up.
Yeah.
And that's the predominant emotion, which is kind of being kind of played upon. Now, what's your kind of thoughts on that? I mean, they're nice. They're nice. It's all very kind of feel good stories, but it's all become quite samey, I think, is the danger. Like, it was good, like, initially, especially John Lewis adverts. It was like, okay, they're nice, they feel good, you know, got a lump in my throat. But now it's the same sort of thing for I don't know how many years it's been going on. How do you feel, you know, when those brands sort of all sort of pile onto this one particular thing, and that's the one singular sort of emotion which is trying to be pushed through advertising?
Yeah. But that's always surprised me, because in life, in a day, we experience so many different emotions, and they are powerful. You know, whether it's joy, surprise, embarrassment, grief, rage, the whole gamut. And the best advertising makes you feel one of those. You know, you just want to feel something. And if all you're ever given is sad, you get you've got that sort of mawkish feeling of yeah, I feel really just a bit teary. It's very hard to stand out. And it's like I was saying earlier with soft drinks advertising before Tango came along, before the Orange Tango Slap came along. It was all felt like they blended in. Every ad was kind of pretty similar, and then Tango comes along, and it's like, we're going to do funny, and it just needs someone to do something just different, just find a different angle. And then I think if they can do it to the standard that John Lewis kicked this whole thing off with, then I think that'd be fine. But I also feel it feels like an anachronism. The Christmas ads feel like an anachronism. It feels like a nostalgia for when advertising was advertising, and we miss it, and we get a little bit of it at Christmas because we're watching TV. We're home with our mum and dad, and they don't have Netflix, and we're watching it. And I think there's a little bit of that, whereas real world doesn't really affect it because most, you know, we've really have, sadly, I never thought it would happen, but we've moved on from the 30-second TV spot for most people. And I'd be a hypocrite if I said, yeah, we should keep it going, because I rarely ever watch TV channels that have ads. So I think it's two parts to the answer, really. I think someone needs to do something dramatically different, but also I think the whole thing is it feels old fashioned, and maybe deliberately so.
Yeah, there's the interesting thing, I think, is that there's, I mean, we haven't even touched upon really like social media, which would probably mean the podcast would go out to 2 hours if we just talked about that influence. But I think what's interesting around John Lewis as well, it's all the change in advertising. Like, you almost don't make adverts to sell a product, or that you just sell, you make an advert in that sense to just be talked about on social media. And what I think is interesting is all of the people I know, of course, they love the John Lewis adverts, you know, wait for them, but they don't shop at John Lewis. And I think there's that interesting sort of disconnect where almost, I don't know, it's not true of all brands, of course, but sort of brands are sort of given up trying to win customers and just focus purely on being talked about. And of course, you know, easy to make the argument that, well, being talked about means that, you know, there's a network effect, and somebody who might shop at John Lewis will find out about the John Lewis advert through this other person who doesn't shop at John Lewis, for example, or that person's propensity to shop at John Lewis increases by certain percentage points. But it seems that there's that sort of, there's become that sort of disconnect in purpose of advertising. Do you feel that, agree with that?
I think so. I think it's also, social media is very much a bubble, and a lot of people aren't on it. And I think if your entire purpose is to create chatter and love and likes on social media, you risk missing a lot of people. And I think on the other side of the story, you can be so controlled by what people are saying about you on social media that it very, very much limits what you're prepared to do or how long you put the ad out for, whether you pull the ad completely. I've been told to, I've had clients wanting to pull advertising because of just a few bad negative comments on Twitter. And you think, well, what have you done to counter those comments? Have you engaged with those people? Let me engage with them. And that's actually quite successful. When a brand engages with someone who's got 15 followers, it's huge. It's huge. They not only like your comment if it's a funny one, even if they've sworn at you, they'll share. So yeah, okay, there's 16 people get it, but then you keep doing it, and you've created something that you didn't have before. Whereas clients can go the other way. I've had other clients go, no, we are stopping this, and this is terrible because somebody said a bad thing. I've yet to see. Maybe I'm just the wrong market because I'm not massively on Twitter, or I don't follow the right people. But, you know, I don't know many things that are famous just because of it, or just because of Facebook. There are brands that are doing really well because of it, but they're not brands that are what I'd call famous brands in the sense that everybody knows about them. So when you were a kid in the 90s, you would be aware of so many more brands just because you were in the room when they were being advertised, or you were driving past something, or it just was fed to you somewhere. And so you had an awareness of numerous household cleaning products, mortgage lenders, airlines, everything, holiday companies, which you weren't in the market to buy because you were like 12. Whereas now, if you're you know, a teenager, you are so directly fed the things that people think you're going to want that, you know, I say brands to my daughter who's 14, and she's just never heard of them. And it's like, wow, that's like been a famous brand for like 100 years.
It just made me think of, there was a life insurance brand, I think. And they're like, men in the men's toilet. I can't remember which one it is. They're in like a men's toilet in some corporate, in a bank or something. And then the song starts, the one which is like, there may be trouble ahead. And can't remember, but now I'm like, oh yeah, that was for like life insurance. I don't think I have life insurance, but like, it still sort of stuck with me. Like, even like, just it was dug away in the back of my mind, and now you've mentioned it, and I'm that doesn't happen with
no because other ones. Well, there's nowhere now, unless you're watching, you know, the, I don't know, the World Cup or final of an X Factor, I'm a Celebrity kind of thing, you're not really going to get mass views on a piece of advertising, like film advertising.
Mm.
If you're really lucky and you do something like the Nike, where the guy took the knee and it sort of just went totally viral. If you've got the budget, the idea and the budget to push it, I think that's incredible. You can get that. Most brands just don't have the budget to push even what are quite good ideas to the world, the wider, you know, universe of people who might just see it. So yeah, I think it's really hard now, but outdoor is still outdoor. Everyone goes outside. Most people live in towns and cities, have buses drive past them. It feels so underused. And that feels like one medium that since I've started advertising has just declined and declined and declined. When I was at advertising college, I used to walk from Cricklewood Broadway to Brent Cross in North London, Northwest London. And it was just the A5 and it was billboard after billboard after billboard. And I'd just stand in front of them like I was a tourist going around the Louvre. I was just staring at what I saw as art. That was my inspiration. That was making me want to get my portfolio better, to get a job at AMV or BBH or somewhere where these geniuses worked. And now I look at them and it is almost like, I wouldn't even say AI's written them, because that's an insult to AI. It's just somebody who's not, someone's just written a brief in more words than they should have done, on a bright background, and that's it. And they found a stock shot. And that probably is what happened, because it's cheap.
Yeah.
You know, it's a couple of grand to get one of these billboards. And it's just diminished. And I feel that's potentially the next advertising revolution. It sounds like quite an old one, but make outdoor brilliant again. Because it's like if you look at stuff in the early 1900s, it was like signs everywhere and they were bad. They would have said, meat, 7 shillings or something. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, pear soap. Yeah, what about it? Nothing. Pear soap. That's it. We've gone back to that.
You get a lot of that in Berlin. They're still painted on the side of the buildings.
They're classic. But our local paper here in Tasmania is people just putting their business cards as small ads. It is something that you would hand to someone that has just got your name, your phone number, and a logo. It's like, that's not an ad. Maybe it is.
Yeah, I think I had to Google because it was bugging me. So the brand who did that life expectancy thing was Allied Dunbar, which probably also doesn't exist anymore.
No, they don't.
And I remembered, again, from the back of my mind, the catchphrase at the end, which was, for the life you've not yet lived, which is also brilliant,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I do remember the song. But yeah, there's not much. There's not much that. It's funny. There's not many ads that you remember, really. You think you do, but when you think how many ads there were, I recently, in a quiet moment, I went through. There are people who actually put 90s TV ad breaks on YouTube, and I just don't have copies of some of my old ads. So I scroll through to see if I can rip my 30 seconds out of it, and a very bad recording. And you just look at all the ads there, and there were thousands and thousands of them, and they were just so throwaway. People seem to make so many more ads than they do now, and they just weren't great. They didn't stand the test of time. So the ones that you remember that do are the 0.01% of everything out there.
You know, there's one of my favorite ads ever. I can't remember when it was made, but I find it funny. It's not supposed to be funny, but it's Just For Men, which is a brilliant brand. And there's a dad. I'm going to tell it to you, and it won't sound funny, but for me, if you go away and watch it, I think it's hilarious. It's a dad who like can't get a job because he's got gray hair. So he uses Just For Men. And I think at some point he's struggling with his tie, and his little young daughter does up his tie. And he's done his hair. He's got lovely brown hair. He goes away to a job interview, comes back, and he says to his daughter, and he's like, well, I think I'm going to need more ties.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just such weird copywriting, but it just, I, yeah. I love it. My wife knows I love it because I talk about it so much. But it's just, yeah, just funny how even like I think sort of bad copywriting can be hilarious. And
well, performance. That was a great performance. You know, it's just like you don't always get the best actors in advertising. You're lucky if you get someone who can get through the script in a not too hammy way. But there was a great Alka-Seltzer one from the 60s or 70s. And it's a guy sitting on a bed. His wife's in bed and he's just sitting there at night. And he's just saying, I ate the whole thing. And he just keeps saying it, the whole thing. So in awe of himself. Yeah. His stomach's gurgling a bit. The whole thing. I just love that. I say it all the time now.
Oh, I have to go back and find it.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah, so one thing I'm going to have to throw this in just at the very end is like what, because we did touch upon it, like the influence of social media. For me, it was interesting because I thought that I would really end up having sort of a career in advertising. I studied art my entire life and it seemed like a natural progression. Mm. I ended up actually, my first job was at MySpace, which was at the time the biggest social network in the world.
I had a MySpace. My band had a MySpace.
Yeah. I mean, it was cool once. Like now, now I really like show my age and everyone's like, yeah, okay, granddad. Yeah. And for me, it was very interesting because I felt like, and especially when Twitter came around, Twitter started getting big only because TV presenters started using it, which was about 2009 when it started getting big. But it felt like, and a lot of us who were kind of in that industry, we were like, sort of, social media is a rebellion against advertising. We always used to say, like, social media is about having a conversation. Advertising is just broadcasting to you. Brands are just talking at you and they don't care what you have to say. Mm. And then it did change. And then brands did start getting more involved in having those conversations. Then it's changed back where advertising on those social media platforms did sort of seem to take over again, especially on Facebook because they were so good at it. And then it was just broadcasting again. And it's kind of gone back and forth between brands basically wanting to be your friend, which I think is an interesting phenomenon, and not wanting to disrupt you. And that was sort of the thing. We're like, we don't want to disrupt what our users are doing. And I think now I'm pretty much desperate to be disrupted for something which will enliven my otherwise kind of quite boring life.
Yeah.
Which is something which is like bigger than everyday life. And I feel like that's sort of what's missing from advertising. It has a role to play. And exactly like you were saying about out of home, there is this opportunity to do something bigger than sort of life itself. And it will be basically like a win for the brand and a win for the person because they're hopefully seeing and experiencing something which they weren't expecting. And I feel like people want to be disrupted in a positive way these days.
I think they do. And I'm reading quite an interesting book at the moment by a guy whose video I watched, it interrupted me and it was very, very entertaining. He's a guy called Sabi Subri. He's an Australian guy. And it was one of those make money fast ads. You know, I gave up my job and blah, blah, blah. But it was so entertaining. And he was giving away a free book, so I bought it. No, I didn't buy it. I just sent off for it and it's free. And he's very much a kind of a clickbaity kind of thing. Whereas his idea is give people something, give a headline, you know, 10 things divorce lawyers don't want you to know. Number 6 will blow your mind. And you've got a piece of content that is going to be helpful to you. You're not selling to people. And he said, a lot of ads are the equivalent of going up to someone in a bar who you find attractive, who you've never met before and asking them to marry you. It's just, for goodness sake, just offer them something like interesting conversation or, you know, a good suggestion from the menu. I don't know, do something to extend the metaphor. So he's very much in just stop trying to sell. But having said that, his bit of interruption was very, very good. And I think you're right. If you're going to interrupt and be brilliant at it. If you're going to be talking to me on social media, be sociable, be social, be interesting, be interested in me, offer me something that you think I'm going to want, start some kind of a dialogue with me, but don't just shout at me and broadcast and transmit stuff at me, hoping that I'm going to be interested in your mortgage rate or your new Lexus or whatever it is you've got. It's like, just be more human, maybe.
Perfect. I was going to ask you, like, what is your kind of final thought? But I think that's probably as good a kind of, you know, point to finish on as any. To just be more human, I think, is a very good point. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much for spending the time to chat to me. We did go over. I said at the beginning, before we started, I was like, I want to try and keep it to an hour. It's so difficult to do that, but we were just kind of flowing, and I feel like I could talk for it for hours on end. So,
subject, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just so ingrained in like everyday life. People don't really kind of think about it, I think. And I feel like personally, I have a bit of a longing to see, not necessarily the exact same sort of adverts as we saw in the 90s, but there's some magic there, which I feel like is missing a little bit. And maybe it is just the humor or the surrealness, which I'd possibly love to see come back. So that's, you know, why it's been so amazing to kind of have this chat with you and kind of get your thoughts and memories from that period.
Yeah, it's been lovely chatting. It's been nice going down memory lane a little bit, but also keeping our feet firmly planted in 2023. And I'm excited. I think it's gonna, you know, it can, and I think will get better. We're just learning new tools and new tricks, and just need to keep doing the very, very best work that we can do, and hope we get clients that like it and take it from there, really.
Yeah. I think if we got onto like, what does the future hold, and like, how does AI play a part, then that's really not, it's another podcast. We'd be here for a very long time, I think. So definitely something that I'd be interested to touch upon, because I think that AI is going to have a massive impact, and not just that, there's so many other sort of technologies which potentially could, augmented reality, virtual reality, and it would take a long time to go over all of that. So
we can either shake an angry stick at it, or we can understand it and see what we can do with it. I think that's probably a more healthy way of approaching it. So yeah, who knows what the future's holding. We'll wait a bit. We'll do another podcast in 20 years time.
We'll be talking about, oh god, the adverts in 2023 were amazing.
Oh, weren't they? Yeah. Those media things, it was great.
Before it was beamed directly into my retina, and when I go to sleep, I have to then go through two adverts before I'm allowed to go to sleep.
Oh, my body was teleported to the checkout with the product in my hand.
Had to get a special subscription just to check out in a timely manner.
Fabulous.
That sounds terrifying.
I know.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this wide-ranging chat with Chaz. I know I certainly enjoyed it. And as I said at the beginning of the podcast, it was a real honor for me. If you're interested in any of the things that we discussed, then I would suggest to check out Chaz's website at chazbayfield.com. Here you can find all of the ads that he worked on, and there's some really interesting articles on his blog there also. It won't be such a long wait for the next episode, so stay tuned for more from The Talk Show.